From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state lawmakers head back to Lansing from their summer break to figure out a budget with money to fix those roads.
Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about what the Republican proposal is going to be. Most of the conversations have been behind closed doors.
School librarians vanishing from Michigan schools, even as student reading scores decline.
There was, for a while, a little bit of belief that school libraries were coming obsolete, and that is far from the case.
And Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon on the question, is playing football in school really worth it?
If you go to the right program for the right reason. If all it is the NFL, if all it is national titles, you're being used and you're making a mistake.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Later on today's program, Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon talks about his new book, Overtime, looking at the Michigan Wolverines at the crossroads of college football. And we'll also talk about the dwindling ranks of librarians in Michigan public school systems. But first, as students across the state say goodbye to summer, state lawmakers are doing the same thing. The state legislature starts its fall session on Tuesday, and there is a lot that needs to get done, beginning with the budget. Shana Roth is here with us now. She's a legislative reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hello, Shana.
Hey, Cindy.
And Riley Began is with us, political reporter for Bridge Magazine. Riley, welcome. And here we are 5 weeks away from the October 1 start of the state's new fiscal year. Is it safe to say, Riley, budget is job one?
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty much people agree that it is going to be the only thing on people's minds until the end of the day on September 30th.
So, Shana, what do you, your take first? What are the major sticking points for legislative leaders and Governor Whitmer as they try to get this deal done before that deadline?
I mean, the biggest sticking point is really the roads, and more importantly, how are we going to hit that more than $2 billion benchmark that Governor Whitmer has sort of put in the sand, saying this is what we need in order to really fix our state's crumbling roads. As a lot of people are aware, she presented her budget back in March, and she said we need to increase the state's gas and fuel tax by 45 cents per gallon. And Republicans have really, really balked at that idea, and they're saying that that is just not possible, that people can't afford that. So they've been trying to come up with some sort of alternative plan that Governor Whitmer would also be on board with. So that's going to be huge for this budget. But also, how do we pay for the other big things, including education and environmental cleanup?
And Riley, I think it seems pretty safe from reading your reporting in Bridge and the reporting that Shane has been doing. People pretty much agree, yeah, we need over $2 billion. It's how to get there. Is the governor's 45-cent a gallon gas tax increase, where does that stand?
So both of the leaders in the legislature, Senator Mike Shirkey and Speaker of the House Lee Chatfield, have said that is not going to work. They are not behind that idea. You know, Mike Shirkey has agreed that we do need that amount of money, but Lee Chatfield is not really fully on board with that yet. He's trying to kind of move things around within the budget to try to avoid increasing taxes. But unfortunately, we don't know a lot about what the Republican proposal is going to be. Most of the conversations have been behind closed doors.
And it certainly is clear from your piece in Bridge that House Speaker Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Shirkey are not on the same page. So Mike Shirkey's kind of admitting the need for those higher taxes.
Yep, exactly.
And when we've heard a number of like almost like little thought balloons popping up from Lee Chatfield, including something involving teacher pensions, but there's been no, so I'm hearing you say no real substantive plan from the GOP to say, here, we have this instead.
Yeah, they have basically, both of their budgets have hinted at some possible room for changes, but they haven't said exactly what they want to do. You know, Chatfield has said we should eliminate the sales tax on gasoline, which is dedicated to schools and local governments, and that instead that money would go to roads. But the governor has said, I am not going to do that unless you can show me where the money for schools and local government are going to come from elsewhere.
How likely do you both think we are to see a roads deal that will include new revenue, which means higher taxes? What do you think, Shana?
I think we will probably see one before October 1st. I mean, I think that's kind of, I mean, we'll have to see at least some sort of a deal before that deadline. But I think at some point it's going to be either they're all going to be able to agree on something or behind closed doors and then sort of come out and say, hey, look, everybody, we've got a budget, which I think is what they're hoping to do at some point. Or what's going to happen is GOP leaders are going to get frustrated with Governor Whitmer and her not agreeing to their ideas. And they're just going to release their own plan and say, see, this is what she should sign. This is what we think. I will note that last week, Shirky and Chatfield had a meeting with Governor Whitmer. This was supposedly where they were going to present some sort of idea. And while they are keeping their official negotiations confidential, Governor Whitmer claimed that their plan would cut public education resources and wouldn't raise enough money for the roads to begin with. And Republican leaders have come out and said, actually, that's not the case.
Riley, what's your take? If you were betting, how likely are we to see a roads deal that will mean higher taxes for that new revenue?
I mean, if there are three major players in this and two of them are saying we need a little bit more revenue, I think it's likely that something is going to come out of that. I really doubt it's going to be a 45-cent increase. That kind of seemed like an opening volley. But, you know, this is the governor's major campaign slogan, her big promise. You know, she made a bit of a compromise on auto insurance, and sort of the word around town here is that, you know, she's going to try to get something from them in exchange on roads. We don't know what that's going to be, but I have a feeling that money will be involved in the final solution.
Is there any thought that the governor would consider a budget without a roads plan, Riley?
She has said that she will not sign anything that doesn't involve, you know, some sort of real solution for roads. So unless she changes her mind on that, I don't think that's going to happen.
And Shana, there was a memo or an email that went out from the state budget director late last week to every department head in state government. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was essentially the email that said, everybody start batting down the hatches, you know, get ready for a potential shutdown. This is something that obviously nobody really wants to happen, but they have to be realistic. And in the email, Kolb said, we are closing in on the month of September and we are without a signed budget for the fiscal year. Because the new fiscal year is just over 5 weeks away, they have to start contingency planning in the event that they don't have a budget. He says that, you know, they're going to be optimistic, but they have to start preparing and figuring out what that's going to mean for different departments, because while the government might be shut down, there are still parts of it that will have to work despite the shutdown.
So that kind of little warning shot across the bow,
yes,
came from State Budget Director Chris Kolb. If you've just joined us, we are talking about the impending beginning of the fall legislative session as we talk with Riley Beggin, political reporter for Bridge Magazine, and Shana Roth, the legislative reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Riley, what other big priorities do you think the legislature will try to tackle apart from the budget, and roads?
Yeah, after we get through September, it looks like there are going to be a couple different things that might be able to make progress on. The first one is this sort of continuing trend of criminal justice reform legislation. Both Republicans and Democrats in the state house are seeing pretty eye to eye on this right now. So there's legislation that would raise the age of a juvenile in the criminal court system from 17 to 18. Some legislation related to expungement, specifically, you know, including past convictions involving marijuana possession, and then a bunch of bills that are kind of trying to prevent the next Larry Nassar from happening. So those are some of the criminal justice things that are coming. You know, there are some environmental protection initiatives that may be on the table. Some of that involves the budget and some of that is outside of that, but, you know, related to helping water utilities swap out old service lines, you know, installing contaminant filters on drinking fountains, researching PFAS. And then another big thing is skilled trades training. Both the Republican legislature and Governor Whitmer have said that it's important to make sure that Michiganders are prepared for a changing economy, and that's something that we may be able to see movement on as well.
And what are you keeping your eye on, Shana Roth?
Really all of those things, particularly the criminal justice reform. From what I'm hearing, they might actually start with some of those bills this week. They recently had a task force on that issue. So I really think we're going to see a lot of, you know, bills surrounding criminal justice. I also think that we're probably going to be seeing some education bills being kind of focused on and put through the legislature. There's the third grade reading law that I think some people are a little bit concerned about what the practical impact of that is going to be and are keeping an eye on that. But for the most part, I think it's going to be budget, and then it's going to be criminal justice and environment are going to be sort of the big sticking points over in Lansing.
And Riley, your piece in Purdue, you did kind of a rundown of what could be on the front burner at some point. Talk a little about government transparency. Certainly it's something Michigan has taken some heat for, the lack thereof. And there is a package that is kind of cooking.
Yeah, so there are actually two really big government transparency packages going through the process right now. One of them would open the legislature and the governor up to Freedom of Information Act requests. People have said there are some loopholes left in this, that can allow them to continue to shield information. But it's certainly a lot better than what we have right now, which is both the legislature and the governor completely exempt from FOIA. And then there's another bill package that would require some financial disclosures, and that's really intended to allow the public to see possible conflicts of interest that legislators might have. Maybe they're voting on some legislation that would affect gas stations, and they own a gas station chain is kind of something that we would be looking for. Those are both in process. We're not exactly sure when they'll see movement. A big reason for that is that Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey is not thrilled by either one of them. He said that they both would need some changes before his chamber is going to be able to take them up.
Finally, are we going to see anything as far as gun control measures, do you think, this fall, Shana?
That's a good question. And that's one where I tend to be more pessimistic about them. Obviously, there was recently two mass shootings in one weekend. We saw a lot of the usual reactions to it, which is, something needs to be done, but whether or not they're actually going to be able to come to a consensus about that. There are red flag bills in the legislature sort of waiting for some level of movement. Those were introduced by Democrat Representative Robert Wittenberg. He's tried to pass these bills for years now, and essentially these are the ones that would allow for family members or people who know someone who might be a risk to themselves or others to report them to law enforcement and have them take away their guns. Whether or not we'll see any movement on that, it really, I think, probably depends more on what happens nationally and whether or not President Donald Trump is actually on board with some changes in order for Republicans to follow through.
Shana Roth, Michigan Public Radio Network, joined by Riley Began from Bridge Magazine, keeping watch on what's happening under the dome in Lansing. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon on his latest book on University of Michigan football and whether the sport is worth it for the next generation of athletes. That's ahead here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's talk about kids in football. Follow me a bit with this. There are 1,086,627 football players in this country at all levels. Only 6.5% of high school players will make a college team at any level. That's 20,052 freshmen. And the percentage of those freshmen who make it to the NFL, just 1.6%. So what does a kid really get from playing football? Michigan Radio sports commentator and New York Times bestselling author John U. Bacon dives into that very question with his newest book, Overtime, Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines at the Crossroads of College Football. Now, John, you thought, and I think you told me, you were done writing about college football.
So you thought.
So what brought you back? What is the story you just had to tell with this book?
A simple one in some ways. Jim Harbaugh had come back to Michigan, of course. It seemed to be, by all appearances, to be run the right way in terms of academically. They're top 4 or 5 nationwide. It seemed to be clean to me, near as one can figure any of these things. They're winning 10 games 3 out of 4 years. Is it enough for the fan base, basically? Keep in mind that Bo Schembechler has got the building named after him and a statue in front, and he never won a national title. Is that still good enough? That's kind of the question. And in this case, I wanted to find out if the fans would embrace this program, if the players felt it was worthwhile, the risks and the sacrifices they make, which are tremendous, by the way. And so I want to dive in to find out what it really meant to the players. Their parents is a new angle here this time. Mm-hmm. And also the staffers. I've got chapters on this whole machine that operates 24 hours a day, I swear to God, that you've got no idea about, fans and non-fans. One of the great insights I got from one of the staffers, they love the question, what do you do in the off season? And they laugh at this one. In the off season, we scale our hours back from 100 hours a week to 50 hours a week, because that's what these jobs take.
Wow.
And the players, they're not that far off either. So the whole question is it all worth it?
And I have to ask, what's your pitch to readers whose loyalties may lie with other teams? What'll they get from reading this?
Well, one thing you get is what I just talked about, which is how the whole machine works. Look, the videographers at Michigan work pretty much the same way they do at Alabama or Michigan State or Ohio State. The nutrition programs, the strength programs, these things are elaborate. Also, you get kind of the live feed. I interviewed 8 players, stars and non-stars, almost every week throughout the season. And you get a real-time feeling of what it feels like when you're ripped on Twitter by a stranger. What does it feel like when you win a big game? What does it feel like when your parents see you get into the game for the very first time after 5 years on the squad? So you get what it feels like for the whole operation, basically.
Sure, walking through.
And we also got the bigger questions, too, about the risks and rewards and how to fix it and all the rest.
So you wanted to draw back the veil and show us just how this team works, a team works, a Division I team works, when everything is humming. Why do you think you got so much cooperation from everybody, including Coach Harbaugh and his family?
First, it must be said, 14 months ago, they did not want to cooperate. So I had to do some persuading. It was not, hey, come on in, let's take a look. It was a few things. I think, one, this is not my first rodeo, my first book. So almost everyone in the book knows somebody I've talked to previously, and no one's gotten burned by talking to me. Also, I do something that very few journalists do. Christine Brennan at USA Today does this, but she's about the only one I know of. When you talk to me, I send your quotes back to you before they go out, which other journalists think is crazy. It is not a license to rewrite the whole thing or write my book, certainly. But I always have some corrections. They might pull back a little bit, but they add a lot more otherwise. Most folks are willing to own strong opinions if they know they're not going to be taken out of context. So that was one reason. Third reason is obvious, and that is that if you thought you were cheating, don't invite a journalist in. That's my advice. So people who do, like Bill O'Brien at Penn State in 2012, people who do this are quite confident in what they're doing.
And you go out of your way to show how clean things are, especially you spend a lot of time on recruiting. And also on the fact that, as you quote Director of Recruiting Matt Dudak, name another school that competes with the Blue Bloods athletically while competing with the Blue Bloods academically. Is Michigan an outlier in that, do you think? Or would other schools say, hey, our kids are the same. They're academic all-stars and athletic all-stars.
Some schools can say that. I would say Northwestern, Notre Dame, Stanford have all been, obviously, Notre Dame got to the playoffs last year. All top 25 teams, very strong academically. So they're not the only one by any means. I'd include Penn State under Bill O'Brien and Joe Paterno. I don't know about James Franklin either way. But it's still a pretty small club. And when Michigan's going after these players, they're trying to beat Alabama for a player, or they're trying to convince Sean McEwen, their star tight end, not to go to Harvard. It's an unusual mix.
So you really do get a sense of what the process of recruiting, and I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that. I mean, 2 years at least. And
2 year process.
Yeah, starting with thousands of names.
4,900 names they start with. And some coach or staffer sees at least a minute of every one of those players. But on the 300 players, now you do it with 10-minute highlight reel, good and bad plays. Michigan puts together, not the player. Mm. Out of the 300, as Matt Dudak said to me, if you get your hand out for money, there's 100. You're not coming here. If you can't cut it academically here, there's another 100. Can't cut it here. We're down to about 100 that we can really want and get.
I want to talk a bit about some of the players that you choose to profile in Crossroads and why you were drawn to them in their stories. Give me just a real quick, Grant Newsom.
Grant Newsom, future NFL All-Star. His parents went to Princeton, did not want him to play football. Blows out his knee against Wisconsin, horribly, almost lost his leg in 2016 and realizes he can't play football anymore. And now he's getting his master's in the Ford School while coaching the tight ends. And I asked him, would you do it all again? He said, every minute. And his father told me, because I was debating my own son. He's 4 years old now. He's got to be bigger, faster, stronger than his dad, more talented to play football. Mm-hmm. But we were wondering before the book started, would we let Teddy play football?
Yeah.
And when Grant Newsom's dad, Leon, told me, my son is prepared for whatever the world can throw at him, and I thank Michigan for that. I think, right program, right coach, yes.
Jared Wangler.
Jared Wangler, his dad's the all-star quarterback at Michigan.
John
Wangler, of course. His dad had never scored a touchdown at Michigan Stadium in the end zone, only passing, 26 passing touchdowns. Jared, his fifth year, comes back, turns down a full ride at Indiana, pays his own way his fifth year, scores a touchdown, and he said, he's going into business. He said, I'm better prepared than everyone else.
Noah Furbush.
Noah Furbush is 10 times smarter than I am. He's getting his master's in space engineering, not aerospace engineering, but space engineering, working on a NASA grant with 20 other doctors, professors, and so on to build a vehicle to go to Mars and back while playing outside linebacker at Michigan. He had no plans for the NFL, no dreams of it. He wanted to beat Ohio State. He's from Columbus, and they didn't. And he said, I learned that even when you put your best in, it's not always enough.
What do you think will most surprise fans, John, who turn up or tune in to watch Michigan football when they read the book to learn what these kids have to do to be a member of the team?
Few things. One, they're human beings, and they thought about all this. They know what you're tweeting. They know what you're saying. They're on the inside. Second thing is they're bona fide students. They really are. I've had them in my class, for the record. I have flunked two starting players and got no pushback whatsoever from the athletic department, from the counselors, anybody. And they wanted these players, trust me. These guys earn their keep. They've got a record number of academic All-Big Ten students on this team. They're real students. Third thing is they are very careful publicly. Most of them avoid the bars. A drunk frat boy comes up to you at 1 o'clock in the morning. He wants to pick a fight to show how tough he is. They get each other out of there. It's like a SWAT team in like 30 seconds.
You describe an incident. You're right. It was highly efficient. Get them out before everybody gets their cell phone cameras going.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a three-pronged life. The main point was Matt Dudek's. There are 8,760 hours in a year, and we see 60. And this book is about the 8,700 hours.
What do you think parents and fans and players will take away from the stories that you tell about the staff, about Coach Harbaugh, and about these kids? What surprised you the most?
They're impressive. And no matter how cynical you might be going into it, and I understand why you might be, because I have shared that many times, it's hard not to be impressed by these young guys. It's hard not to pull for them as individuals. Forget the rah-rah, I can't do that as a journalist.
Right.
But when you see them out there, you care about them, and you realize how much goes into this. It's a human story.
And the life lessons outweigh the very, very long odds of playing in the NFL, which Michigan coaches tell kids NFL means?
Not for long.
Not for long,
that's part of Harbaugh's speech. He said, these 4 years are for your next 40 years. And the great quote comes from Bo Schembechler himself, who said, what kind of team are we going to have? Come back in 20 years and I'll tell you. Because that's when I'll know what kind of fathers, husbands, workers, community people you have been.
Well, when you stop and you think of the headlines as we talk today about quarterback Andrew Luck walking away from being the Colts quarterback.
Can't blame him.
Age 29, is tired of living in pain, tired of injuries. It does kind of sharpen your focus that it can't be about that ring at the end.
And he was ripped for this. The home fans booed him leaving the field. And by the way, if you heard at 29, you're going to hear a lot more at 49 or 59. So I salute him for doing that, and I boo the Indy fans who booed him.
So it's worth it? The kids say, yes, they would do it?
If you go to the right program for the right reasons. If all it is the NFL, if all it is national titles, you're being used and you're making a mistake. If you are getting more than that out of it, then it's probably worth it.
John Eubanks, his latest book, Overtime, Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines at the Crossroads of College Football. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
If you want to know what things were like at a certain point in history, ask the people who were there. Oral histories are a priceless way for us to peer into the past and learn. That's the idea behind the Traverse City State Hospital Oral History Project, a collection of recorded interviews with former hospital employees. This hospital shut down in 1986, so the interviews give us insight into what mental health treatment looked like in the mid-20th century. Stuart McFerrin heads this project, conducted the interviews, and is with us now. Stuart, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thanks, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Where did this idea come from? Sit down with former employees of the Traverse City State Hospital and record their memories.
Well, I was contacted by Ann Stanton of Mission Point Press, and she had a list of people that were willing to be interviewed. And I have to say it was a real pleasure talking with these people who had a very difficult job and worked that job for many years. There had been a book written in 1957 called A Man Against Insanity, and Mission Point Press had reissued it. The sales from that book were able to be put into funding this project.
Okay. All right. So it got it going, and you sat down. And what did you personally hope to get from the recording sessions?
Well, I didn't really know much about the Traverse City State Hospital when I started, so I didn't really know what people would say, but I spent quite a few hours talking with them and hearing their stories, and all their stories were very different, very interesting to me.
So what did you learn?
Well, my first interview was with Peg Wagner. She was 19 years old in 1947 when she first started at the Traverse City State Hospital. And that was just after World War II had ended. And she said she applied at the hospital and started work the very next day. They were really short of help.
Since you're mentioning Peg, let's take a listen to just a little bit of your interview with Peg Wagner, who began working at the hospital, as you say, right after the war in 1947.
It was quite an experience when I first went there, because I was only 19 years old, and I'd never seen anything like that before.
What are some of Peg's memories that stick with you? What did she do there and what did she see?
Well, she described a woman that swallowed spoons, and it was shocking to her and frankly to me to hear that. And they had to put her hands in a muff to try to control her urges to swallow these objects. And over quite a period of time, she swallowed many objects and she had to have operations. And that was one side. But then the whole other side was when Peg was working there, the farm operation was in full swing. A lot of the patients or residents at the Traverse City State Hospital worked in various parts of the farm. They had a vegetable ground, a dairy farm. I believe they had a pig operation, a swine farm where they raised pigs. A lot of the residents would work every day on the farm.
Yeah, in fact, in listening to her story, she talks about organizing peeling parties, helping them process those vegetables from the hospital farm. So the Traverse City State Hospital pretty much saw the first two-thirds of the 20th century. And why did it ultimately close in 1986?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, a lot of the residents and patients at the Traverse City State Hospital worked on the farm. And at some point, somebody said, hey, how come they're not getting paid? So at that point, they decided they needed to pay the patients for the work they did on the farm. And that added all kinds of complications in terms of funding the hospital and paying the patients who worked there. Well, one of the guys I interviewed, Art Nickerson, he had talked about the transition between community mental health and the Traverse City State Hospital. And at some point, there was a general nationwide trend to try to get people out of the institutions into the communities.
Yeah. And speaking of Art Nickerson, I know in listening to the interview you did with him, he worked at the hospital along with a lot of members of his family. And he talked about a time when new drugs were becoming available for mental illness.
They did have a trial medicine program. And we would get medications from the pharmacy with just a number on prescribed for a certain patient. And we didn't know if that was an actual trial medication or if it was a bottle of placebos. Most of the patients were committed involuntarily, so if there was any permissions, I would guess they would come from the family to try the medicines.
Stuart McFerrin, what struck you about the way mental health care was delivered in those mid-century years in the hospital? What have you learned?
Well, a lot of the people there were, in a sense, warehoused. There wasn't effective treatment, and they needed to be managed and cared for. There wasn't effective treatments for their mental illness. And there was a number of people that had been admitted to the hospital, you know, maybe decades previously, and they were still there. There was really no diagnosis. There was no really reason they were there other than the fact they had been there for, you know, 20, 25 years. So that was actually a very common result.
Were the employees that you spoke with, do you get the sense, were they happy with their jobs and with their roles?
I think generally, yes. I think it came down to a lot of them had made statements that it was a good place to work, that they were there to help people. And they talked about the culture of each ward. Every ward had a different culture. For example, Bob Maddox told a story about one of the wards that he would visit on occasion. And there was a man on this ward, a patient or a resident, and he was in his 70s, and he was a fiddle player. He had a fiddle, and he loved to play his fiddle, and he would play it all the time. And the people that worked there on the ward regularly would hide his fiddle because they got sick of him playing it. And so when Bob Maddox would go to that ward, he would find the fiddle and give it to the guy right before he left. And then the guy would go through his repertoire and kind of drive all the people that were working on the ward crazy.
Now, how many employees have you interviewed so far?
About 10.
Still looking for more?
Yes. And a lot of people have asked me, well, have you interviewed any patients? And I would love to interview some patients that had stayed at the Traverse City State Hospital.
What happened to the building once the Traverse City State Hospital closed in 1986?
Today, they've renovated a number of the buildings, and there's condos and apartments, and I believe there's an assisted living program in one of the buildings.
So it has been repurposed. The architecture has not been lost. And you can actually find these histories by going to thevillagetc.com. That's thevillagetc.com. And you can surf your way over to the Traverse City State Hospital Oral History Project. Interviews conducted by my guest, Stuart McFerrin. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, only 8% of Michigan public schools have full-time school librarians. 65% of our schools have no paid staff in their library. What does all of this mean for kids? That comes up after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The constant barrage of news about climate change, drinking water contamination, pollution in the Great Lakes, it can feel overwhelming. If you care, it's hard to know what to do or where to start. That's where Stateside's new series comes in. We're featuring ordinary people who identified a problem, no matter how big or small, and they chose to act. These are the people in your neighborhood working to make Michigan a greener place, and we're calling them the Climate Crew. This time, we're looking at the 22 million pounds of plastic that end up every year in the Great Lakes. And that's where Jackson Regler and his clothing line comes in. Jackson is with us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
Tell us about your clothing line.
So I own an apparel company called Ashki, which means fresh in Native American Ojibwa. And we repurpose plastic waste from the Great Lakes and around the U.S. and make it into recycled polyester, which is then produced into all of our clothing. And I launched this in the last month or so. Ashki's actually been around for around 2 years. I founded it 2 years ago, kind of in recognition of the threats I was seeing to the Great Lakes watershed. And since then, we've kind of pivoted into repurposing plastic waste. When I did a lot of research this coming year as a student at the University of Michigan, I just finished my freshman year, and I did a lot of research on, you know, repurposing plastic waste. And I thought it would be a good way to pivot my company into redesigning my supply chain. And so I worked on that diligently over my first year at the University of Michigan, and it's been a great response thus far.
So you are going into your sophomore year at the University of Michigan. You are not a New York fashion designer. You're not a material science engineer. You started Ashki when you were in high school. What got you to step up and get involved in environmental issues?
So, you know, growing up really close to Pier Marquette, Lake Michigan, right on the shores in the small beach town Muskegon, the Great Lakes have always been something I'm super passionate about. And so I did actually an internship at the Annis Water Research Center as a freshman at Michigan. And we really studied like threats to the Great Lakes watershed. And I think what really pushed me over the edge was you have all these, you know, looming threats of Asian carp and the Line 5 pipeline and all these issues. And the administration in office 2016 put a $300 million budget cut to Great Lakes funding and proposal. And so, you know, when you see that the importance of the Great Lakes to our community and really to the world altogether, I mean, you have to act. And so,
and as well as addressing this problem of plastic waste in the Great Lakes, you are also concerned with the issue of fast fashion. What is that? Why is that a problem?
Absolutely. So that's something I really studied over the last year especially. And so there's the issue of people just, you know, buying cheap garments in, you know, every single different color and every single different style because people want the cheapest and the most variety that they can have. And so a statistic that really popped out to me was, I think since 2000, people have bought like twice as much clothing, but have kept each garment half as long. And so if you look at, you know, all industries since 2000, I think you think of things getting a lot better environmentally. And in fact, the fashion industry has gotten worse. And so when you look at industries in recent times becoming much worse, especially since 2000, because I feel like our eyes have been open to issues of, you know, plastic waste and becoming sustainable and climate change and all of those environmental kind of issues have, I think, been brought to our attention in this generation more than any other previously. And so when I saw that the fashion industry was getting worse, it's like, you know, we have to act up, you know, someone has to do something. And so it really comes down to making sustainable garments that are going to last a long time, durable garments that are going to, you know, hold up through whatever you're doing. And that was kind of what was in mind when redesigning our supply chain this last year.
What is your ultimate goal? Where do you want to take this clothing line? What would success look like to you?
I think I really want to push the boundaries of reusing plastic waste in innovative ways that no other apparel company has done. So, you know, I want to be making shirts that are going to last 20, 30 years, making garments that are going to undeniably last a very long time. And as well as, I think, you know, just really helping the overall industry move forward and moving the fashion industry overall towards a place where we're thinking smart, thinking sustainably about, you know, what kind of designs we're doing, how often the turnover is, and, you know, how durably and well-made each garment is.
What do you think, as someone who's doing it, is the best way to get people to do something, anything, to become involved in environmental issues?
You know, it's a tough thing because you have people of all different sorts of beliefs who are shaped kind of by their own experiences throughout their lifetime. So, you know, some people are, you know, believing in the environmental really crisis that we have in front of us, and some people aren't. And so when you're trying to get as many people active as possible, I think it really comes down to giving them science. People, I think overall as a generation, we believe in, you know, science. And so when you give them statistics that are point blank true, such as, for instance, the fast fashion issue of, you know, we're making twice as many garments, but we're keeping each garment half as long. It doesn't take a big political or ideological debate to put those facts in front of someone. And so I think when it comes down to getting people active, it's not about personal beliefs or politics. It's literally just, you know, you got to put the stats in front of them, you know, just point blank doing the facts. It's not about your personal beliefs. It's not about, you know, which side you're on in the political spectrum. It's about, we need to do something because we're ruining the planet. So I think that's the best way to approach it and getting as many people as involved as possible.
Jackson Rigler, using recycled plastic in his clothing line, Oshki. Thanks so much for talking with us, Jackson.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And we know there are many others like Jackson out there. We just don't know about them. So we need your help. If you know of anyone out there working to make they're part of Michigan, a greener place, please let us know. To nominate someone, you can send us an email with some helpful information. Send it to stateside@michiganradio.org and put Climate Crew in the subject line. That's stateside@michiganradio.org. School librarians are in danger of becoming extinct in Michigan. Just why has that happened, and what does it mean for our kids and their literacy skills? Kathy Lester is a school library media specialist and technology coach in Plymouth Canton Schools. She's at East Middle School and past president of the Michigan Association for Media in Education. Kathy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Kathy, a report in Chalkbeat Detroit tells us that 92% of schools in Michigan do not have a full-time certified librarian, and we've seen the number of school librarians in Michigan drop 73% from 2000 to 2016. What happened?
I believe that it's a combination of things that happened. First off, our state went through a pretty large recession and funding was cut. And since school librarians tend to be a single person in their building, it seemed easier to cut those positions than to cut classroom teachers. And so that was one thing. I think another is that there was, for a while, a little bit of belief that school libraries were coming obsolete. And that is far from the case. If anything, I think school librarians are even more needed today than in the past. We're all about information, not just books. And that information is online. It's all sorts of media, whether it be video, audio, print, electronic resources. We deal with all of that and help our students navigate that.
And I think that's, it's worth kind of digging into that. I think if people have not been to school in a number of years, they've got an image of someone who sits behind a desk and helps kids find a book and navigate the drawers of little index cards and the Dewey Decimal System. Tell us more about how things have changed.
Well, we've always been about information, and so we've changed with the times as the source of where people get their information changes. We've changed right along with that, and we're still about reading and building library collections that meet our curriculum at our school, as well as the reading needs of all our students. We have training on selection and creating a diverse collection. And so we build that reading culture at our school, but then we also help build students' college and career readiness. And through that, we teach research skills. We teach students how to navigate that world of information out there and how to avoid false information, where to find some really quality information, how to cite their sources, how to avoid plagiarizing sources, what copyright is. We're, you know, strong believers in supporting the copyright laws. And we also teach our kids digital citizenship skills. So in today's world, kids need to know how to be safe online. They need to know how to communicate in effective means while they're online. So we teach all of those skills as well. And that's why we are certified teachers. And the last thing that we do is we've always supported technology and technology integration in our classes, and we've changed along with that technology. Years ago, it might have been film strips and VHS tapes, and now it's online resources and digital video, digital audio, and we help teachers integrate technology in meaningful ways with classes and teach students how to create. I don't know if you've heard of the maker movement, but school libraries and librarians are a big part of that maker culture and maker movement in teaching students critical thinking and creativity skills.
So not having a librarian at your school if puts kids at quite a disadvantage. I can hear this huge array of services and kinds of learning that school library media specialists like yourself offer.
Right, that's true. And there's studies that show that schools with a certified media specialist at their schools, the kids not only have better reading scores, but they also have better scores on ACT exams. They're more likely to graduate from high school. They have better research skills. So it's like that whole array of things that we support at our schools.
Kathy, give us an idea. Just give us a few examples of what it's like across Michigan in terms of how many students and how many librarians they have.
Well, I think statewide, our ratio are about 3,400 students per librarian, where the national average is right around 1,000. So we're 47th in the nation in terms of supporting our school libraries.
And what does this look like on the ground in some districts?
And in some districts like Detroit, they have 3 certified librarians for that whole district, and they are at 3 high schools, and they're 3 of the higher performing high schools like Renaissance High School, Cass Tech, and the Detroit School of the Arts. But there is really many of the elementary schools don't even have a library in Detroit. So that concerns me about the equity for our students.
So for students who do not have a librarian at their school, how is this impacting them, particularly when we talk about student reading and student literacy? What have we seen in Michigan?
I do see that the students without a school librarian at their school are at a big disadvantage. Without having that access to books, I believe there's a big inequity right now in our state in that respect, that some of the students that probably need our services the most don't have them. Again, studies show that those reading scores are even go up even more, are more important for our students who are at risk. So maybe come from high poverty areas or have special needs or things like that. We actually support those students more because for a variety of reasons, they may not be getting that support at home, where maybe a student from a higher economic background might get more support at home.
And yet we stop and realize that Michigan prisons are required to have a certified librarian on staff. Michigan schools are not, but there is a package of bills being put forth by State Representative Darren Camilleri, who taught before going to the State House. Tell us about this package.
Representative Camilleri, Representative Colazar, and Representative Pagan have introduced three bills in the House. And the first bill is to require every school to have a school library. And I know that many people just assume that they do, but they do not. The second is to then require each one of those libraries to be staffed by a certified media specialist. And then the third is to have staff in place when the school librarian is out for a variety of reasons, whether it be that I'm like in a classroom teaching the classroom, someone's there to keep the library open while I'm out. So those are the package of three bills, and obviously our association is supporting those bills, and there's a lot of other organizations and that are supporting that as well.
Kathy, we know there are districts where money is a big, big challenge. How are they supposed to find the funding to number one, have a library, and number two, have that certified librarian?
I do believe that, you know, Governor Whitmer is trying to get more money for schools. And in a certain sense, too, I think school districts need to look at their priorities. I teach in Plymouth Canton schools, and we get the minimum per pupil funding right now, but yet somehow they were able to prioritize to have a certified school librarian at every school. Same thing, I live in Brighton, and Brighton schools are in a similar situation, get the minimum funding per pupil, and they also have a certified school librarian at every school. So I think a combination of the two things, hopefully we'll be able to get more money for education, number one, and then number two, have schools take a look at their priorities.
Are there enough librarians to fill positions, or are fewer people choosing to become certified librarians?
I believe that there have been less people choosing because there weren't any jobs available in the past, but Wayne State University has a new program for currently certified teachers to earn the additional certification for library media in 15 credits, and it's all online. And they're ready to ramp up to accept more students, and they had a really large interest in that program and had a good number of students taking that program this summer. So I think that there are people also who were essentially maybe laid off or forced into early retirement, and they would be also be interested in going back as well. So it may take a bit, but I do think that we could fill the need.
Kathy, what's at stake here? What do you see as the future of school librarians and libraries in Michigan?
Well, I'm hopeful that I'm mostly concerned about equity to our students, but I'm hopeful that I see a small trend where schools are adding back this position and trying to energize their school library programs. So I'm really hopeful that that trend will continue. Of course, I would love to see the bills go through and pass in our state. I believe every school should have a minimum set of services for our students, and that all students should be afforded those same services. So I'd like to see those bills pass, but I am very hopeful.
Kathy Lester, school library media specialist and technology coach in Plymouth Canton Schools. Kathy, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And that's our show today. Tomorrow on Stateside, we learn more about a West Michigan high school that's being overhauled with mass shooters in mind. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.